headlines. A colleague of the Palestinian journalist Sharon Abu Akleh tells Press TV that Israeli forces deliberately kill her to silence journalist reports on the regime crimes. Another Palestinian teenager is fatally shot by Israeli regime forces during intense clashes with Israeli settlers near the occupied West Bank. And another deadly shooting in the United States leaves 18 children and 3 adults dead at an elementary school in Texas. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisumi Shah Ahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. 1 week into the tragic death of Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akleh, Israeli forces have refused to accept responsibility for her killing. Another Palestinian reporter who was next to Abu Akleh when she was shot says the regime deliberately targeted her to silence journalists. In an interview with Press TV, Shatta Hansaya dismissed claims by Israel that the veteran Al Jazeera Arabic journalist might have been hit by Palestinian fire. She says that Israeli troops killed Abu Akleh to stop media coverage of the regime's crimes. She also said that since Israel seeks to evade accountability, it will not allow an independent investigation into Abu Akleh's killing. She said it is a regular thing with Israeli forces to kill Palestinians and get away with it, as nobody bothers to hold them to account. Abu Akleh was killed while covering a raid by Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank city of Jenin earlier this month. She is widely believed to be killed by Israeli forces. The Associated Press said Tuesday that its own investigation supports assertions that the bullet that killed her came from an Israeli gun. But the regime says that its own investigation has not determined that narrative. Israel says even if that is the case, it does not appear that the soldier who fired the gun will stand guilty of criminal misconduct. Iran's deputy permanent representative to the United Nations has deplored Israel's assassination of Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akleh. Zahra Ershadi said the reporter's killing is part of Israel's long-standing and well-documented war, harassment, intimidation, and violence against journalists. The Iranian diplomat said the regime targets journalists to cover up crimes that it commits against the people of Palestine. Ershadi described Abu Akleh as another victim of the international community's inaction in the face of continuous Israeli atrocities. She called on the UN and the Security Council to take urgent action to end Israel's impunity and ensure protection for Palestinian people. Abu Akleh was fatally shot while covering an Israeli raid on the occupied West Bank city of Jenin on May 11th. Another Palestinian youth has been killed by Israeli regime troops following intense clashes with Israeli settlers near the occupied West Bank city of Nablus. Palestinian media said the 16-year-old Bait Rafiq Yamin was shot in the head after hundreds of settlers stormed the tomb of Joseph, Prophet Joseph, that is, near the city. Violent clashes then erupted between Palestinian youths and Israeli settlers. The Palestinian Red Crescent says over 75 people have been injured. A resistance group based in the West Bank city of Jenin says its forces have shot and injured a number of Israeli troops who accompanied the settlers. Hamas also issued a statement blaming Israel for the escalation of tensions in the West Bank. In the United States, people have just seen one of its deadliest school shootings in years. A gunman has killed 18 children and 2 adults at an elementary school in the state of Texas. The suspect has been identified as 18-year-old Texas Governor Greg Abbott says that the suspect is also dead, apparently killed by police officers in the town of Uvalde. Reports say that the gunman drove up to the school and entered with a rifle and a handgun. The carnage follows a series of mass shootings in the United States this month. Despite recurring mass casualty shootings, multiple investigations and reform gun regulations have failed Congress. leaving state and local councils to enact on their own restrictions. A new report by the FBI revealed that the U.S. experienced 61 active shooter incidents in 2021, showing a sharp rise over 2020 and the highest tally in more than 20 years. North Korea has fired three ballistic missiles towards the sea off its coast just days after a visit to South Korea by U.S. President Joe Biden. South Korea's Joint Chiefs of Staff said the launch was carried out in a span of less than an hour from the North Korean capital, Pyongyang. This marks the latest in a blitz of weapons tests by the North this year. South Korea and the United States have agreed to scale up joint military drills as well as deployment of American weapons. President Joe Biden and his new South Korean counterpart have agreed to deploy more U.S. strategic assets if necessary amid North Korea weapons tests. The European Union remains split on imposing an oil embargo on Russia, with Hungary signaling that it will not back a proposal. In a letter to the EU chief, Carl Michel, Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban said that it appears that it is unlikely for a comprehensive solution to be found within the special meeting of the EU, which was held earlier this month. Diplomatic sources say sanctions on Russian oil will be on the agenda during the summit. The Hungarian Prime Minister says banning Russia's oil would only deepen internal divisions and offer no realistic solution to tackle them. Hungary has already imposed a new state of emergency, citing the war in Ukraine. The European Union calls for talks with Russia on possibilities of reviving the export of wheat and other food supplies from Ukraine.
I think this is a very complex topic, we also need in some way some dialogue with Russia on that one. It cannot be in Russia's interest that because of Russia, people are dying of hunger in the world. And therefore, I think we should first of all look at the dialogue with Russia, whether there is not an agreement that this wheat gets out of Ukraine.
The European Commission president stressed that food supplies from Ukraine are necessary to prevent a global food crisis. Kiev says Russia has blockaded all of its ports, a claim Moscow has rejected. On Monday, the Kremlin blamed Ukraine for making its own commercial shipping impossible by placing mines along the Black Sea coast. Ukraine is one of the top wheat producers in the world. Kiev says its exports have fallen sharply since Russia launched a war on February the 24th. The war and the West's anti-Russia measures have pushed up prices of food commodities in many countries. Iran's foreign minister says the country will use all of its legal and international capacities to prosecute those involved in the assassination of the IRGC member in Tehran. Hossein Amir Abdullahian made the remarks in a message to the family of Colonel Hassan Zayed Khodai, who was assassinated on Sunday. He said the assassination proves that Iran is in the forefront of the fight against terrorism. Amir Abdullahian said Iran has been also a regular victim of state terrorism. The foreign minister censured the silence of certain countries that falsely claim to be fighting terror and advocating human rights. The IRGC's top commander, Major General Hossein Salami, has vowed Iran's response will be tough and will make enemies regret the heinous crime. Earlier, we reached out to political commentator Mustafa Khoshtesh for his take on the matter. He explains why Iran is well within its legal rights to respond to the act of terrorism.
Well, definitely this is going to be responded. Some people might think that how about previous operations? Iran has always vowed to take revenge. And they might have questions if this has happened ever. Well, Iran and Iranian officials, especially the top military, are not in the habit of acknowledging responsibility for operations. And when you hear the Israelis claim responsibility, it's not their officials, but it's their media in order to escape responsibility, because this is a clear case of assassination and terror, and it should be condemned. I mean, the Israelis should be condemned for that. And when the UN fails, other countries fail to condemn and punish Israel, then according to the international rules and regulations, Iran has every right to take retaliation.
A 10-story building has collapsed in Iran's southwestern city of Abadan. A rescue operation is underway at the site of the Monday deadly incident to help people trapped under the rubble. 29 people, that is, have already been pulled out. 14 others have been confirmed dead. Yusuf Jalali has more.
The casualties are rising as a commercial building in Iran's southwestern city of Abadan collapsed on Monday. The 10-story building is located in a busy area in downtown Abadan. It crumbled on the surrounding shops and cars. Rescue workers estimate that 80 people are still under the rubble.
In the early moments after the collapse, rescue teams were dispatched to the area to save possible survivors from under the debris. The removal of the wreckage is slower in the early days because of the possibility of finding survivors.
The Metropole building was an unfinished twin tower. One of the twins of the building crumbled, and local authorities warned that the adjacent twin could also fall any moment.
Because of the instability of the adjacent building, it's highly likely that the other twin will collapse any moment. I should thank the rescue workers who have dared this risk and are working to recover those trapped under the rubble.
The cause of the collapse is still under investigation, but experts say faulty design and construction is the major cause of the incident.
Understanding the exact cause of the disaster needs more thorough probe by experts. We will update our nation as soon as we get accurate information on this issue.
Teams and equipment from other cities, including Tehran, are scheduled to be sent to the site of the incident to assist with the rescue operation. However, local authorities say adverse dusty weather has hampered the dispatch of choppers and teams.
As the rescue operation goes on, it is expected that the death toll will rise. Yet the worried families of the victims cannot leave the site of the incident, with the hope that they may find their loved ones safe and sound. Yusuf Jalali from the city of Abadan.
The Yemeni army says that it has shot down a Saudi drone over the capital, Sana'a. It says the incident is the latest violation of the UN brokered truce, which will expire in a week amid efforts to extend it. Abdul Latif al-Bashali reports from Sana'a.
The spokesman of the Yemeni army, Yahya Sariya, says the country's air defenses shot down a spy drone operated by Saudi Arabia with a locally made surface-to-air missile. Sariya says the aircraft was carrying out hostile acts in Yemeni airspace in violation of the UN brokered truce, which came into effect on April 2nd and expires in days.
A combat drone belonging to the Saudi-led coalition that was flying over Sana'a was shot down and fell here on the Ruwaishan crossroad. The Saudi-led coalition continues to violate the truce, and unfortunately the United Nations has not taken any action to protect the truce that it sponsors.
Local media say three civilians were killed and three others were wounded after the drone crashed in a residential area in Sana'a. In the wake of the incident, head of Yemen's negotiating delegation Mohammed Abdus Salam says the Saudi-led coalition is responsible for a possible breakdown of the peace process. The negotiating team says the UN should hold the coalition to account for its actions.
In the face of all these violations and delays in implementing the terms of the armistice, the United Nations must hold the obstructing party that violates the terms of the armistice fully responsible. The United Nations cannot impose the specific sanctions on any of the parties, but it can at least condemn the violations. Therefore, the United Nations must take a positive attitude and condemn any party that violates the armistice that it sponsors.
The two-month truce mandates a nationwide ceasefire. Under the agreement, the coalition must also allow fuel ships to enter the port city of Hodeidah. However, the Saudi-led coalition has repeatedly ignored its obligations.
The new violation of the UN brokered truce once more demonstrates how Saudi Arabia is blocking a political solution in Yemen by its repeated breaches. People here demand that the United Nations take action and adopt a clear stance against the infringements by the Saudi-led coalition. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Afghan health experts are sounding alarm over the deteriorating healthcare system in their country. They say Afghanistan will soon run out of medicine if urgent action is not taken. Rahmatullah Bakhwan reports from Kabul.
Rights groups warn that people are dying from lack of medicines in Afghanistan. Afghan Medicine Services Union also says that medicine supplies in the country are running low and that no medicine might be available to the patients within the next 2 months.
Afghanistan is facing an unprecedented drug shortage and a sharp rise in drug prices. These days we are supplying drugs from our stocks and reserves, and I'm afraid they will run out of medicines within the next 2 months. This situation has hit our nation, health sector, and drug sellers.
The union blames the banking crisis, major cuts in global aid, and U.S. sanctions for the medicine shortage. It also called on the Taliban to allow traders to import medicine in any possible way.
Medicine shortage is rooted in different problems. Firstly, most world countries have stopped medicine export to Afghanistan since the Islamic Emirate is not recognized worldwide. Secondly, major amounts of drug importers' money is frozen and banks in New York are not cooperating. Thirdly, the Taliban have imposed certain restrictions on drug imports.
Patients in Wazir Akbar Khan Hospital in Kabul complain about their inability to provide medicines, calling for help from the international community to save their lives.
I am from the Jawzjan province. I have brought my child for treatment in this hospital in Kabul. I have been here for 5 days and I have spent all my money on services and medications. Some medicines are very hard to find and some very expensive. The doctor has given me this prescription and I am wondering how to provide the drugs.
This comes as Afghanistan is facing multiple outbreaks of diseases, including COVID-19, measles, and acute malnutrition. Afghan hospitals and clinics are running out of medicines. Doctors here say urgent action is needed to save the lives of patients. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Okay, now that brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
Liberation of Khorramshah, Day of Resistance, Self-Sacrifice, and Victory. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. May 24th is the day of liberation of the port city of Khorramshahr in the southwest of Iran. It took place in 1982 during the eight-year war that the United States and its accomplices had imposed on Iran through their stooge in the region, Saddam of the Ba'ath regime. The day has been named as the Day of Resistance, Self-Sacrifice, and Victory in the Islamic Republic of Iran calendar. Stay tuned for a special feature on this occasion. The history of Iran's holy defense against the Ba'athist eight-year invasion was full of great days whose glory has remained indelibly in the minds of the Iranian nation. However, May 24th is among the greatest and brightest days of the holy defense as it was a turning point in the war and changed the equations of the war against the initiator of the war and his Western and Eastern masters and regional supporters. Khurramshahr is a strategic port in Khuzestan province, southwest of Iran. It is located on the confluence of the two rivers, Karun and Arvand. The city was occupied by Saddam's army on October 26, 1980, after 35 exemplary resistance of young Iranian combatants and ordinary people of the city. Khurramshahr was liberated after 578 days on May 24, 1982, in an honorable operation. The operation was carried out jointly by the Iranian Army and the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, IRGC. The liberation of Khurramshahr was the most important phase of Beit al-Muqaddas, which included four phases. The stiff battle terminated 19 months of the occupation of the strategic port and dealt a very deadly blow to the war machine of Saddam and the morale of Iraqi invading forces. The liberation of Khurramshahr was considered as a prelude to the fall of Basra. As a matter of fact, the Iraqi dictator Saddam had arrogantly said, "If Iranians retake Khurramshahr, I will give them the key to Basra." However, the Iranian brave combatants smashed the Iraqi fortifications and positions just to astound military experts in the world. Nearly 16,000 enemy forces were killed and injured. More than 19,000 others were taken captive by the Iranian forces. After liberation of the strategic port city of Khurramshahr, the Iranian youth performed prayer at the main mosque of the city known as Masjid-e-Jame. The news of this great victory was soon spread across Iran and made the whole nation happy. Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, issued a message in part of which he said, "I am thankful for the telegraphs sent to me on the liberation of Khurramshahr. Unlimited gratitude should be expressed to Almighty God who has helped and supported the Islamic country and devoted and selfless combatants and granted us his great victory." Elsewhere in his message, the Imam said, "It is God who liberated Khurramshahr." Imam Khomeini, in fact, meant to teach a lesson to the Iranian combatants and nation not to fall in the vanity to think that they had gained victory without God's help. Anyway, the liberation of Khurramshahr taught Saddam and his Western and Eastern masters and his supporters among the reactionary Arab regimes not to think of another invasion of the Iranian territory and values. Leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, said on the liberation of Khurramshahr, "When our armed forces started their move with prudence, sharp-sightedness, willpower stemming from faith, trust in God, using all facilities so that they didn't let the least thing be wasted, and relying on their power and trusting in Almighty God, no one in the world believed that they could liberate Khurramshahr. But they succeeded. When we announced that we had retaken Khurramshahr, the news agencies of the world were not intent to release the news looking at it doubtfully, but this occurred, and in the end, everyone was forced to admit this victory. The city of Khurramshahr was liberated, and it turned into the unforgettable memory of unity, resistance, and victory of the Iranian nation. It is a lesson to mankind that God supports and helps the oppressed and those who have been kept weak and inferior. It has inspired hope among poor nations to stand against tyranny and oppression till ultimate victory.
Food for thought.
Salam, and let us ponder today on how to dress in public, as expounded to us by the embodiment of dignity, Imam Ali, peace upon him. He whose dress is chosen by knowledge will have his defects screened from people.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Thank you. This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle.
Today's lesson, helping the oppressed neighbors. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of helping the oppressed neighbors in the Islamic lifestyle. When we look at the Islamic teachings, we see the importance of having good relation with our neighbors. We see the importance of giving the rights of the neighbors to them. We see the importance of paying attention to the neighbors so that we can have a peaceful place to live. On the other hand, when we see all these importances, there is another right of the neighbor, is that when we see that our neighbor is oppressed by an oppressor, we must help him. We must help our neighbors so that no one can come and disturb them. And Imam alayhi salam, Imam Zainul Abidin alayhi salam, has also said that وَنُصْرَتِ مَذْلُومِهِمْ, when in your neighbors you see that there is a person who needs help and who's been oppressed, you must help him, and you must become a support or a back for the neighbor, that you are helping him in a way that no oppressor can oppress them anymore when they're next to you, or maybe when they're living there. So this place where he's living, the house that he has, at least that place or the area where he's living, this becomes a peaceful place for him, that the oppressors know that they cannot enter to this area, because when they enter this area, the neighbors will help this person. The neighbors will be the one who are the supporters of this person, this neighbor, and that they cannot do whatever they want. And therefore, your neighbor also feels secure living in the house or in that area, inshallah. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of helping the oppressed neighbors. In the Islamic teaching, we said there is an importance of giving the rights of the neighbors. Therefore, when we know that there is a neighbor who's been oppressed by an oppressor, we must help him in order to make the place where we are living peaceful. And on top of that, when we help others, they also help us. Obviously, it's a general formula or general rule that tits for tats, that when we help someone, they also help us. When we try to make an area where we live a peaceful place where no oppressor can oppress anyone, then obviously our neighbors will also help us. And on top of that, it is emphasized in the Islam that when it is from the rights of your neighbors, وَنُصْرَتُهُ إِذَا كَانَ مَظْلُومًا, you must go and help your neighbor when you know that he is oppressed. And this is not only related to the place where we live, that in that area only we need to help. But on the other hand, for example, if we know that if one of our neighbors has been oppressed and he needs our help, we must go and help him. Maybe he needs a witness. Maybe we witnessed something that he was oppressed by someone, and tomorrow in the court he needs that witness. We should not shy. We must not fear, because this is from the rights of our neighbor. And Allah does help us when we help the mustadhafin, when we help those who are oppressed. When someone helps the oppressed ones, Allah does help us. Allah gives us the courage. So this courage is given by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and we must do that. We must help our neighbors, especially when they are oppressed. And this is from the ethics and the rights of the neighborhood that we must pay attention to our neighbors, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Cultural news, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With the light.
Artists in a small town in the United Kingdom have created a massive bumblebee mural, hoping to raise awareness about this vanishing species. The mural was painted on the playing field of a primary school in the town of Haptonbridge. It was debuted on International Bee Day. The artist used paints typically used to draw lines for football pitches. Scientists say rising temperatures and heavy pesticide use are contributing to the decline in the number of bumblebees across Europe and North America. They say the population reduction rate is consistent with mass extinction of a species altogether. Children at a school have also created a wildflower meadow to help encourage bees to pollinate. A print art exhibition chronicling nearly a century's worth of artistic achievements by a Chinese woodcarver has been unveiled in the city of Suzhou near Shanghai. The carved into wood exhibit features nearly 80 of Huang Yongyu's wood blocks and prints. Woodblock printing is a form of Chinese art dating back hundreds of years. In this form, patterns are carved out of a thick sheet of wood to create a type of multi-layered surface. Then ink is applied in various stages to print the image and its colors. The humble 98-year-old artist said during his years of practicing art, he learned that sincerity mattered more than technique. The exhibition was launched in collaboration between Suzhou Museum and the Beijing Fine Art Academy.
Persian fallow deer is a unique but endangered species known for its sleek and spotted body. In this report, our correspondent Youssef Jalali takes us on a quick tour around one of the world's few protected shelters of Persian fallow deer in Iran's city of Sari.
We had to keep quiet and avoid making any sounds to film them, as they are shy and swift, and the slightest sound could send them sprinting and jumping away. Over 60 Persian fallow deer roam in Dashtinaz Wildlife Refuge in Iran's northern city of Sari. The endangered species is carefully protected here to be safe from predators and poachers.
The Persian fallow deer is native to Iran's Khuzestan province, but due to loss of habitat and threats posed to them by predators such as jackals and wild cats, they are endangered and need to be protected in semi-natural refuges like this one.
Persian fallow deer are mainly indigenous to open woodland areas spanning from East Mediterranean coasts to West and Southwest Iran. By 1875, they had gone extinct in all of their main habitats, except in southwest Iran. After a captive breeding program, the population has rebounded from only a handful of deer in the 1960s to over 200 individuals in Iran.
Dashtinaz Wildlife Refuge is a 55 hectares wide,
It was introduced in 1962 as a shelter for the Persian fallow deer when the species was on the brink of extinction. At that time, 5 deer were captured and translocated to this refuge. Over the past 6 decades, their number have been multiplied through captive breeding.
The Persian fallow deer is a rare ruminant mammal belonging to the family Cervidae. They're physically larger than other fallow deer, and their antlers are bigger and less palmate. Their special beauty has turned this sanctuary into a hot tourist attraction in Iran's north.
This sanctuary is a tourist destination for visitors who would like to see the Hyrkanian forests in Iran's north and at the same time enjoy the wildlife and learn about efforts made to save the Persian fallow deer from extinction.
In 2015, the Persian fallow deer was registered in the IUCN Red List of Threatened Species. Dashtinaz authorities hope through continued captive breeding, the population of these special creatures will soon reach the desired number, and hopefully they will be reintroduced to their natural habitat in southwest Iran.
While they live far from their original habitat, these alluring creatures feel at home here, where they will be safe from the dangers lurking outside, which may lead to their extinction. So here, Persian fallow deer continue to embellish the nature and charm visitors with their beauty. Yusuf Jalali from Dashtinaz Wildlife Refuge in Sari.
The lush green oasis near Sudan's capital, Khartoum, has turned into a haven for dozens of exotic bears from all over the world. The sanctuary shelters over 100 bears of 13 different species. Here, visitors can feed lovebirds, parakeets, rosella bears, and many more. The owner of the sanctuary says he trained the bears over the years to make them human-friendly. Akram Yahia says he has a passion for bears and enjoys it when people come around to see the sanctuary. The sanctuary, which is part of the Marshall Nature Reserve, is a welcome break for the people from the hectic life in Khartoum and nearby cities.
He tried to create an environment that doesn't exist in Khartoum. These environments exist in other parts of Sudan, such as in the west of Sudan, in the east of Sudan, in rainy areas. These areas have environments such as this one, and perhaps even more beautiful. He created this environment in Khartoum, where there is not nature at all.
Domestic and foreign tourists are allowed there only 2 to 3 hours a day. The limited hours are so that the bear's living environment is not disturbed. The owner built the 400-square-meter sanctuary 4 years ago. Over the years, he has added trees, garden, pond, and mist nozzles for cooling off against Sudan's scorching heat. Yahia says he wants to expand the reserve in the future.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Indonesians have held a dazzling event to celebrate Vesak, a day traditionally observed by Buddhists in South Asia and Southeast Asia. People gathered at the sprawling Borobudur Temple in central Java and released lanterns into the sky. That's part of prayers marking the birth, enlightenment, and death of Buddha, a spiritual teacher who lived during the 6th century BC. The release of lanterns symbolizes letting go of negativity. The occasion lasts 3 days, which includes collecting holy water, sending off lanterns, and meditation. This year, the event was limited to some 1,200 people because of the coronavirus risk. Because of the outbreak of the pandemic, the ceremonies typically receive 20,000 people at the massive temple complex.
A group of over a dozen penguins has been released back to the sea after being given a second chance to live.
The condition of these specimens, which fortunately could be reinserted, is very common to find. They are animals that appear stranded on the coast, found with malnutrition, dehydration, hypothermia, and a high degree of parasitism. Specialists call this condition the stranded penguin syndrome.
The penguins were rescued and taken to the Mundo Marino Foundation, where they were rehabilitated. They were kept warm and were fed liquids until they could eat fish again. Before their release, blood and other samples were taken, and a chip was implanted to track them. One of the penguins was a southern rockhopper, which is a species listed as endangered. Biologists at a rescue center say there are many reasons why penguins get stranded and malnourished. These include overfishing, global warming, and other environmental changes. Thousands of people crowd into the British city of Norwich to watch a 2-kilometer-long string of dominoes topple, while winding through town. Some 7,500 breeze blocks were set up for the event. The dominoes slinged through street buildings, windows, and even climbed up stairs and trees. The toppling lasted 30 minutes. The moving sculpture was installed across the city with the help of some 200 volunteers. The artistic director said the work was chosen partly because it was a spectacle and both disrupted the city and engaged its people.
There's a sense of anticipation that goes with the work. You would have seen people around town at the moment. Everybody's asking, what's going on? And then when they realise what it is, then there's this sense of, oh, and when are you going to knock it over? So that it's a sculpture also that gets destroyed in many ways, and that's really part of the work as well. I mean, I like to think about it as a child almost playing with the city. You know, they're setting everything up, and we all know they're going to knock it down at some point, and that's fun.
Daniel Bryan said he was excited about the project because it looked like a child had taken over the city with the joy of knocking down dominoes. The cascading dominoes ran through two cities, eventually ending at the site of Norfolk and Norwich Festival of Arts. The organizers say the goal of the installation was to bring unity to the community. Chilean paleontologists unearthed a rare, fully intact fossil of what is known as a sea dragon discovered from a melting glacier deep in Patagonia.
It is the first complete and excavated ichthyosaur that has been found in Chile. It also corresponds to one of the most complete fossils ever found on the planet for the Cretaceous period. It is the only pregnant ichthyosaur that's been found on the planet from the era between 129 and 139 million years ago. So it's incredibly important.
The 4-meter-long fossil is nicknamed Fiona and swam the seas some 250 million years ago. Scientists say the specimen will help them understand this species and its embryonic development. The expedition lasted over a month because of the remote nature of the find in the Patagonian glaciers. Paleontologists had to make a 10-hour hike just to get to the site. They also had to camp in extreme weather conditions while maneuvering tricky, rocky surfaces. But collecting and transporting the fossil was a whole other story.
As we went down excavating, weakening the rock, we realized the skeleton was mostly complete, so much that the bones were pushed inwards and we had to make 5 blocks of approximately 200 kilos each to move it.
The blocks were then airlifted to the Rio Seco Natural History Museum in southern Chile to be prepared for exhibition. The fossil was first discovered by Ruth Pedro more than a decade ago, but because of the site's harsh terrain, its extraction was a complex challenge. Scientists also discovered over 20 other specimens of the same species during the expedition, bringing the total found in the glacier area to 100.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The U.S. is the most untrustworthy country abroad, as is evident by its foreign policy of state terrorism around the world, as the forcibly divided Koreans will attest, and as the Ukrainians are beginning to find out after being pushed into an unnecessary military confrontation with Russia by American presidents, or more properly, the pro-Zionist cliques that controls them. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Kayhan, international staff writer. This article is published under the heading "Goofs and Gaffes Expose the State of Affairs at the White House." Stay tuned for more. The thousands of South Koreans protesting against the visit of U.S. President Joe Biden outside a hotel where he's staying in Seoul know for sure that the person approaching his 80th year hardly controls himself, let alone controlling his country. Yet they carried placards with his crossed-out pictures, saying Biden, more properly, the pro-Zionist clique in Washington, which has sent him on a six-day tour of South Korea and Japan, is after stoking tensions and possibly war with North Korea. Even his embarrassed host, President Yoon Suk-yeol, who recently silently suffered the humiliation of being addressed by Biden by his predecessor's name, Moon Jae-in, whose five-year term ended last month, is aware of the goofs and gaffes for which presidents of the United States are known. As an instance, last year, while receiving in Washington the then South Korean president, Biden had called Moon Jae-in Mr. Prime Minister, and recently, at a plant in Hamilton, Ohio, while addressing workers, Biden bragged that he had traveled more than 50 times to Iraq and Afghanistan, almost a 100% increase when compared to his election campaign speeches a year and a half ago, when he said he has visited the two countries at least 30 times. Moreover, Biden told the flabbergasted workers that his supposedly frequent trips to Afghanistan and Iraq also involved visits to the Islamic Republic of Iran, which is situated between the two said countries, and where, actually, no senior U.S. official has ever set foot since the victory of the Islamic Revolution kicked out from Iranian soil all Americans connected to the clique in Washington. Biden said in Ohio, "I've been in and out of Afghanistan, Iran, and Iraq." It is worth recalling that in 2019, Biden glibly lied during a public speech by telling a false story about traveling to Afghanistan to recognize the heroism of a Navy captain. He's not the lone case of a lying or absent-minded president of the United States of America since his predecessors, such as Ronald Reagan, George Bush Jr., and Donald Trump were known for their goofs and gaffes. The last named was a notorious liar and a terrorist to his very core, who, God willing, will soon be brought to justice for his spate of crimes against humanity, especially the cowardly killing of the famous Iranian general Qasem Soleimani. No wonder with such incompetent persons elected to the White House every 4 years. The U.S. is the most socially destabilized country at home, where racist discrimination has reduced citizens of black color to virtual slaves that are killed at will. The U.S. is also the most untrustworthy country abroad, as is evidenced by its foreign policy of state terrorism around the world, as the forcibly divided Koreans will attest, and as the Ukrainians are beginning to find out after being pushed into an unnecessary military confrontation with Russia by American presidents, or more properly, the pro-Zionist cliques that controls them. Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and welcome to the latest edition of Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. The murder of Shireen Abu Akleh by an Israeli sniper has shocked the world. Her death and the horrifying attack on the mourners at her funeral have even been condemned by governments that staunchly support the temporary entity. Today, we'll look at Shireen's murder and how it's yet another example of the ongoing onslaught against journalists by the Zionist regime. Later in the show, we'll look at how Zionist propagandists work closely with pro-Israel journalists to distort how the world views Palestine. As always, I'll be speaking to experts on this issue to find out more. But first, we've got this special report by Bianca Rahimi on Shireen's murder.
Israel is at war with journalism. Following the horrific killing of Shireen Abu Akleh, which sent reverberations around the world, it is vital we examine some of the less obvious ways in which the temporary Zionist entity fights against exposure of the facts. Shireen Abu Akleh is a name which will echo through the ages. But her name is merely the latest in a long list of clearly identified journalists whose lives were cut short by the Israeli regime. Names like Yasser Murtaja, Ahmed Abu Hussein, Basil Faraj, Fadel Shana, Imad Abu Zahra, Issam Tilawi, James Miller, Khalid Riyad Hamad, Mahmoud Al-Kumi, and Nazih Darwaza should also be remembered. They all wore clothing identifying themselves as press, and all were killed by the temporary entity. The Palestinian Journalists Union says 55 journalists have been killed by Zionists since the year 2000. Since 2018, at least 144 Palestinian journalists have been wounded by Zionist forces across the Gaza Strip, West Bank, and East Jerusalem, hurt by live fire and rubber bullets, as well as stun grenades, tear gas, beatings with batons, according to Reporters Without Borders. Another way in which the Israeli regime expresses its disdain for the reporting of truth is through its insistence on prosecuting Palestinian journalists on the charge of incitement. Between 2015 and 2018, over 500 Palestinians were arrested by the Israeli regime for the crime of incitement for things they posted online. Many were journalists and some were children. Currently, there are more than 15 Palestinian journalists languishing in occupation jails for so-called incitement. Some are being held under administrative